Dr. Ed Goldstein, who received a PhD in math from MIT, and after holding several academic appointments in math, he joined the Harvard School of Public Health in 2008, where he's currently a senior research scientist. He works on mathematical modeling and statistical analysis of infectious disease dynamics, the severe outcome burden and related control measures, drug resistance, and strain coexistence. Dr. Goldstein.
Yeah, and I'm not privileged to have any conflicts of interest either. So I will talk about the estimation of the burden of mortality associated with influenza and stratified by age and by gender, and actually also by an underlying cause, which is one of the primary motivations behind this work. So most influenza episodes are unaccounted for, and only for a small fraction of mortality associated with influenza. Influenza is deemed an underlying cause or even a secondary cause. But if you want to understand the burden of mortality associated with influenza, you have to resort to statistical methods. And it's known that influenza causes mortality, for example, with people with heart disease. In fact, there is more circulatory mortality triggered by influenza than respiratory mortality, a bit more. And so, and there are also people who are hospitalized with influenza. They often have other underlying conditions like cancer, diabetes, and so one would imagine that there is mortality triggered by influenza, which is associated with those underlying causes. But in order to quantify it and in order to assess it, one needs a model which has a good explanatory power in terms of relating influenza incidence to mortality. And the models which exist in the literature, they have several drawbacks, and I won't get too technical into that. So that they assume certain simplistic models about the structure of the non-flu mortality. They take certain measures or proxies of influenza incidence which are not really related to influenza sort of linearly. They're not proportional to the incidence, and there are other epidemiological phenomena that happen along, like the introduction of the PCV7 vaccine, for example, and now PCV13, which changes the baseline of mortality, not underlying influenza. So mortality changed that, and there are influenza itself changes and mutates, and there are big events like the Fujian strain, which came in 2003-2004 season, and potentially it has a different case fatality rate and so on and so forth. So you need to account for those phenomena to get a good model which has a good explanatory power and which fits the data well. And perhaps the part of the reason, if not the primary reason, that the CDC only uses respiratory and circulatory death towards estimating flu-associated mortality, which we believe is a flaw. And part of the reason is that the models that they use, they rarely actually exhibit fits of those models to data, and so they're not very certain how much explanatory power those models have. And for example, they don't quantify flu-associated mortality underlying cancer, for example, which is one of the, we'll see, is an important cause. So we came up with models which sort of address those issues, and let me explain it in some detail. So the first thing that sort of, I guess, the primary contribution was that finding a better proxy for incidence of influenza subtypes. So there are two major streams of epidemiological information about influenza, which is virological testing of specimens and reports from the sentinel surveillance about influenza-like illness levels. And people often take those respiratory specimens which are tested, a look at the percent of them which are specific to each of the major subtypes, which are H3, H1, and B, and deem those measures as proxies for influenza incidence. Of course, they're not really great proxies because people who are tested, they're not members of the general population. These are people who present with influenza-like symptoms. And so this is a percent of a pie which grows as influenza incidence grows. So this percent does not really reflect on the incidence. So we just suggested to multiply the levels of influenza-like illness by the percent of specimens positive for influenza. And we got those proxies for the major influenza strains, which are colored in green, which is H3, blue and red, which is influenza B, and to sort of to get an idea that they work better than the conventionally used proxies, we just aligned them to mortality to excess mortality with pneumonia and influenza, which is a standard way of assessing pneumonia and influenza mortality, not a perfect way, but the black curves are excess pneumonia and influenza mortality, which are obtained from a completely different source. And as you can see, the green curves and the black curves generally align very well, which is indicative of the fact, there is a very good temporal correspondence between them, which is indicative of the fact that indeed influenza H3N2 caused the majority of mortality associated with influenza, and there is a very good temporal correspondence there. You can see some misfits in the model, namely there are spikes in the first 4 years, which precede flu incidence. And these are the years before the pneumococcal conjugate vaccine was in fact introduced. So as I've mentioned in the beginning, the baseline for mortality, those spikes have nothing to do with influenza. This was sort of a holiday season mortality caused by the pneumococcus, which have disappeared largely. It was believed that the spikes and mortality, sort of the infamous spikes that disappeared, they were a result of children transmitting to adults, and indeed there was an influx of pediatric strains around that time. So as you can see, this mismatch, it sort of makes sense epidemiologically. So let me just say in a couple of words just briefly how the model works. So we have a mortality time series. For example, we look at mortality underlying diabetes for men between 65 and 74 every week. Some fraction of it is caused by influenza. We don't know what fraction is caused by influenza. So we have those incidence proxies for influenza. We split them according to the epidemiological information on the Fujian strain. And there is a non-influenza associated mortality, which is given by baseline and trend. So there is trend in mortality for certain causes. And so the idea is, once again, the baseline, you only assume that it's periodic. You don't assume anything about this sort of parametric shape, because those assumptions are, in fact, erroneous. And so then you just fit it into essential linear regression model, though you have an autocorrelated noise. So the basic idea is that the mortality is a periodic baseline plus flu contribution, which is, as you can see, proportional to flu. And then you try to fit the model to data to various time series. And let me just show you one sort of fits to all-cause mortality in the five age groups we've considered. So we considered children, young adults, middle-aged adults, people between 65 and 74, and the very elderly. And as you can see, for the older age groups, the fits are very well, are very consistent. And of course, for the young age groups, the mortality itself is spiky, and the fits are sort of, you can't really, you fit the general shape of it. And the general idea is that if you look on those recurring patterns in mortality every year, this is the baseline. And the spikes, they correspond essentially to the flu incidence. So the flu incidence explains the shape of the spikes. Flu causes about 1.5% of all mortality, but in the peak weeks, it can cause up to 10% of all mortality. And so the shape of the spikes, it corresponds to the shape of the circulation on particular H3N2 virus. And so, as I've mentioned about the baseline, I told you that children get used to give pneumococcus to the elderly. And after the PCV, to all age groups during the holiday season, and after PCV7 was introduced, this has dissipated largely, this phenomenon. And now we have PCV13, so hopefully it will be completely gone. And the model, if you take a non-parametric shape of the baseline, it actually finds those spikes. You don't fit into a parametric shape, you take a non-parametric spline form. And you can see there used to be spikes in mortality during the holiday season for all age groups except for kids, which also makes sense because kids don't give pneumococcus to themselves. They already have it. But they used to have those strains, which have disappeared now almost entirely. And so the model also sort of describes that phenomenon of a holiday season spike, which disappears. So these are all for all-cause mortality, but we fit it for different age groups, for different underlying causes, and we get the consistent fits, as you can see. Sort of the fits are quite consistent, and the model has a good explanatory power. So we can use it actually to ascertain burden of mortality, particularly with various underlying health conditions, which is which are sort of the usual suspects given the hospitalization data. And so let me present the estimates. So let me describe the highlights for, and so this is the table for males. They generally have somewhat higher rates of mortality, particularly for the ones which are the non-elderly. So then females, and then females have similar rates, and I'll talk about the differences. So as you can see, as you would suspect, the average rate of mortality, it changes, I mean, it increases dramatically with age, and it's the highest in the very elderly. And if you look at the elderly, the circulatory and the respiratory mortality together, they constitute, and this is male, but for females, this is sort of similar, that they constitute around 70% of all mortality. But there are other, there is mortality with other underlying causes, which is sort of unaccounted for, and which is, though we suspect that it exists, in particular cancer is a big cause, and there are three more causes which sort of add up to the same thing, which is diabetes, Alzheimer's, and renal disease. So these are all causes which are present among hospitalizations, and so we sort of reverse the argument, and we see that you have mortality with underlying mortality associated with influenza with those conditions, such that the complications are triggered by influenza infections. In particular, one of the interesting results is for middle-aged men, 50 to 64, the rate of mortality underlying cancer associated with influenza is the same, essentially, as the rate for all respiratory diseases, which include pneumonia and lower respiratory diseases. So you can stratify, you can get a finer stratification. For example, circulatory deaths are mostly caused by heart disease, but some of them, around 20%, are caused by strokes and so on and so forth. So we've stratified this in this paper. If you move on to the younger ones, then boys actually, so these are males, they have respiratory deaths, they have deaths underlying heart disease, some girls don't. And they have septicemia deaths, and so do girls. So children is the only age group where septicemia deaths are triggered by influenza. At least we could ascertain it in a statistically significant way. So let me talk about females, and I'll mainly talk about the differences. So if you sort of, as you can see, the all-cause mortality for all the age groups except for the very elderly are a little bit lower. And the main difference in the rates of mortality between females and males is through circulatory deaths. So there are more flow-associated circulatory deaths in males than in females. The same applies actually for cancer, especially for the middle-aged ones, but it's hardly surprising because the rate of all circulatory deaths and also the rate of all cancer deaths in middle-aged men is significantly higher than in women, and the rate of flow-associated deaths is the same. We get the same kind of results. And so we can quantify those rates, and you can actually, I haven't included it, but even for something like chronic liver diseases, there are about 20,000 deaths a year in the United States, and we attributed around 150 of them to influenza. So it's sort of, there are limits of the power of the model. It's barely statistically significant. So I guess let me just say why. Okay, how much time, sorry, do I have? Two more minutes. So two more things that I want to mention is that seasonal influenza H1 had a much larger fraction of mortality in children. So seasons dominated by H1N1, there weren't too many of them, but they had the same rates of mortality for children and virtually nothing for adults. So when the pandemic virus hits, people were very surprised that, I mean, well, maybe not surprised, but they thought it's entirely a pandemic phenomenon, that the age distribution of deaths is so shifted towards the younger ones. But in fact, for H1N1, has always this age distribution was shifted towards the younger ones, including the seasonal one. Some believe it has to do with antigenic sin, with the fact that older people, this is the first strain that they've seen, is sort of questionable. And the last thing I want to mention is this phenomenon which has a horrendous name called harvesting. It suggests that people who die from flu are very frail anyway, and they're going to die soon anyhow. And so, I know, it's a European term. And so, we examined this harvesting phenomena in terms of flu-associated mortality and next summer excess mortality. And you can see, indeed, there is some negative correlation. So the more flu-associated mortality in the winter, the less mortality in the summer. But if you look at the numbers, it's a different order of magnitude. So it's about, so for every flu death in the winter, there is like 0.1 death in the summer, which is prevented, but it's a very different order of magnitude. So let me say one last thing. Why is this work? I mean, why did we do this work? Because There are certain population groups such that, I mean, you can identify, for example, men with heart conditions or with cancer and women with Alzheimer's, for whom there is a high burden of mortality associated with influenza year by year. For example, last season was an H3 season, largely was sort of a fit into this mode. And those people, there is vaccination, which is not perfect, particularly for people with underlying health conditions. But once they get influenza and influenza-like symptoms, the CDC recommends that they get treated with antivirals. But first of all, then many of them are not aware that they should seek treatment during the height of the flu seasons. The doctors, the prescription rates in the outpatient setting are still quite low. Even in the inpatient setting, they're about 50% only. Even though the guidelines say that all the people with high risk conditions. So the idea of this sort of the main motivation of this paper is to promote awareness about those age groups, which are sort of essentially the collateral influenza epidemics. The epidemics are driven by children, but the high risk adults are, and some high risk children, though there are very few of them, are collateral, and this sort of happens year to year consistently. And I believe there isn't enough awareness about, especially about the need to seek medical treatment. And that's, I'll stop here.
Thank you. For one or two questions? No questions? Okay. Do you think the quadrivalent vaccine will affect your estimate?
Influenza B has one more big component, and B is accountable for about 20% of deaths in the elderly. For children, it's also a sizable fraction. I mean, it will help. It's not unhelpful, and the vaccines and the the vaccination levels are higher right now than they used to be during the study period, and there is probably more motivation to vaccinate even more kids in December. So there is a drive till the end of November, and then the efforts taper off, and I think that will actually do more good. I mean, I'm a believer in herd immunity, but the vaccine works, though it doesn't work too great for, especially for people with health conditions. It's just the efficacy is not as good.
Or age, I guess that's a health
and
condition.
Age, well, yeah.
All right, thank you.